Well, I think I'll sit today because I'm more of an amusing mood than I am in a declaratory mood. But I could stand. I want you to know that I really went through, I call it a miracle. When I reached Lugano from India, I could hardly walk without the help of at least two people with somebody behind me to keep me from falling backward. And I was in great pain physically. My arms were in such extreme pain that I couldn't go to sleep at night. And when finally fatigue drove me to sleep, the pain woke me after 2 hours. And that's about all of the sleep I could get. I had long thought that in May of this year I might leave my body. And I was perfectly ready. I don't mind at all. I know it wouldn't be easy for you, but on the other hand, you might as well be prepared for it. It'll happen sooner or later. The thing is that, and Miriam, who's my nurse, said that I could have easily died from any one of three reasons, and they were all there together working at me. I really think that my time had come, and then I just thought, well, God, I don't care when you take me, but if you want me to be here and serve, then it would help if I were a little better than this. And all of a sudden, I became well. I was able to walk without a cane. In fact, I left my cane in Assisi, and my pains went away. Everything went away, and I'm just in fine fettle, you might say. So I think that you're doomed to have me around for a few more years. I can still look back over 40 years of a wonderful time since this community began. And it's a dream that I had from the age of 15 and perhaps even earlier, because I was always, even as a child, looking for an ideal way of living. And it occurred to me, when I was young, the Nazis were coming into power and Hitler was rising, Mussolini was rising. Virtue was on the run, you might say. And there was a great deal of anger, fear, and anxiety in the world at that time. And I grew up not in the midst of it, but I was in Romania, where my brother Bob, who had blonde hair, they used to call him Nazi because they figured he must be German. The times were difficult, and I didn't have to fight through them. We came to this country at the age when I was 13, not we, but I. And I remember we were to go back and I was to go to school again in England, and we left Oklahoma where my relatives were, and we got out on the station platform in Chicago, and the first thing we saw was this headline, Germany invades Poland, and war was inevitable. So we didn't go back. We stayed here in America, and I didn't get to get the brunt of it, but I was very much concerned for it. All my old friends and everybody I knew and the way of life that I had known were being destroyed. Many people we knew in Romania were sent to Siberia, and it was not an easy time, as those of you know who lived through some of it, although most of you aren't my age, you had at least the repercussions of it. And I had this idea of how can man live in peace. And I wrote the first version of my play, The Peace Treaty. I called it The Peace Treaty or Every Man for Himself. And it was these five clans, cavemen climbs. It's interesting, we got the play from Kent School just a few days ago, and it's very interesting to read. And you can see my thinking at that time. what happened was that after this war, just like in the peace treaty, the essentials are there. It's a much more sophisticated play now. And at that time, too, however, it wasn't unsophisticated. And more than that, it wasn't unrealistic. It talked about the one clan made war on all the others, and they all fought him back, and they finally, under the generalship of one general, one person, they were all cavemen, they won the war. And this general who had won the war had an idea for a peace treaty that would ensure peace forevermore. And they all the other lords applauded, as they did in the peace treaty as it is today. And then when it came down to actually writing the play, the treaty, then everybody said, wonderful, wonderful. However, I would like to, I think I deserve, I've been punished enough by these invaders, and I deserve some recompense, and I think that I should have a third of the land that they have. And the next one said, well, I think I should have something too. And they, each one of them sliced a little piece of the pie, as he called it. And at the end, the whole treaty was in shambles as each one grabbed for himself what he could. And the lord of the clan, that the general who had won the war, he said, is this what life is really supposed to be? Does God want man to suffer? And then I came up with the thought that, yes, he does, because he wants man to become perfect. And only by suffering can we grow. Well, this is the truth. We would love to have a world of peace, but isn't it interesting how after every war, the most popular novels are about war? You'd think people would want just the opposite. They'd want novels about peace. People want a little excitement. Master told the story of a man who went to heaven, and a friend of his who had gone to the other place called him on the telephone one day, and he said, well, what do you do up there? Well, in the morning we have prayer, chanting, and meditation. And in the afternoon we do prayer, chanting, and meditation. And the man said, well, for heaven's sake, what do you do in the evening? Well, for a change, we have chanting, prayer, and then meditation. And this man in hell said, oh, you ought to come down here. We have lots of fun. Well, most people think of heaven as a place that really nobody would want to go to. I can easily imagine many a quarrelsome fishwife, let us say, making hell of heaven if she went there. People carry themselves wherever they are, and the influence they project is what they are. And at that time, I'm afraid my view of life was rather gloomy. In the peace treaty as we have it today, I have come up with a positive solution which I think can work. But at that time, the play ended with blows and grunts off stage, and then finally guns, and then a few bombs, then a big bomb, and then silence. And this was my view of the future. And I improved on that view by... Then I imagined a group of people going down to some distant place. My thought was Patagonia, which is far away from everywhere. And a few people with skills would ride out the bad times, and when the world had bombed itself back to the caves, that these people would come out and teach mankind again how to live. And that thought matured so that at the age of 15, I was already thinking in terms of communities as being the ideal solution. And because I'm an enthusiastic type, all my friends became interested until they found that I was serious. And then they backed off one by one, and I was left alone. But I still had the dream, and I still thought, someday I will do this. Then, because I was seeking truth very seriously, even as a teenager, and I reached the point of realizing that everything that I had been trying through social systems, through science, through arts, through music, everything seemed to be, it needed a final thing. It needed God. Without God, it would not work. And I didn't have very much faith in God in those days. I didn't know who he was or what he was. It, to me, was a very great mystery. I remember at the age of 16 saying to my mother that I wouldn't come to church with her anymore. And she wept bitterly because she thought it's so painful to think that one of my own children is going to hell. But I wouldn't back down. I had to be serious and I had to be sincere. I remember my level of devotion in those days was, let's say, not very exalted. One Christmas Eve, I went to church because everybody goes to church on Christmas Eve. And in the Episcopal Church, they serve wine. In the Catholic Church, the priest gets to drink it all. But in the Episcopal Church, everybody gets a little bit. And there was a long line. The church was completely full. And I was near the end of the line. And I was beginning to develop what the Irish would call a mighty thirst. And when the priest put this cup to my lips, he put it there for the usual second and then tried to take it away. He couldn't. I was tilting it up. When he finally managed to yank it out of my hands, there was this loud sucking sound. My brother was kneeling beside me and giggled. I've improved on those days. But I came to realize that without God, nothing's going to work. He's the sort of missing link to everything. You can't find truth if you don't have some sort of love in your heart. What's the use of knowing whether there are 1,000,000,000, whether a few other galaxies, as they told me in school at the Downs in England, that they've found that all the stars that we see are only one star system, and that they found that there are maybe two or even three other star systems. They called them island universes in those days. Well, that was back in the 30s. Now we know that there are 1 or 200 billion galaxies, and a picture of 1 inch square of the space shows galaxies after galaxies. It's incredible, but what does it mean to you and me? And whether there's one other or two other or 100 billion or 200 billion, who's counting? It would take you a lifetime to count to 1 billion. Science without inspiration doesn't give you anything. The inspiration of discovery is what is there for scientists. But once that discovery is finished and it gets into the hands of the Philistines, let's say, what does it do for people? We don't find people happier today because they have telephones and radios and all the various gadgets that people have now. When you discover some new cell phone, you're happy for a moment, and then it's the same old thing. For reasons like this, I refuse to learn how to get onto the internet. If you want to reach me, don't send it on the internet. I do use email because it's very handy. And yet I don't like to keep up too much with scientific discovery because it's endless. Man will never find what he's looking for through science. He can never understand the truth of everything. Back in the 20th century, in the 19th century, they were saying that man has already found everything he could possibly find. Charles Duell, I think his name was, or the head of the patent office, recommended to President McKinley, if this legend is true, that the patent office be closed because everything that could possibly be invented had already been invented. And since then, we have the telephone, the car, the airplane, the radio, the television, everything that we know of society and civilization today was created since then, including our roads. The endless variety, however, has not made people more happy. Science will never give you understanding of everything either. Back in the 60s, scientists were saying, well, we pretty well know how things work. Since then, they've discovered so many things that they just had to throw that theory out the window. But they'll never know. Because finally, What really helps you to know is not your reason, but your heart. Reason and intellectuality are like living next door to a very good restaurant, knowing its menu, knowing its reputation, knowing everything, but not being hungry. So you don't go. Why would you go if you're not hungry? Hunger is what you need. You need to hunger for truth. You need to hunger for joy. You need to hunger for love. And these things can be fulfilled not in human, but in divine ways. And so it is that finally, God has to be a part of the picture. I remember a long walk I took. I was 21 years old at the time. I was in Charleston, South Carolina. I wanted to be a playwright and a poet, and this was my ambition at the time. But I realized after a time that I wanted these things because I wanted to share truth with everybody. And the longer I went in my search, the more I realized I didn't know truth. So why should I flood the world with my ignorance? And I gave up writing. I gave up everything. And I still didn't know what the answer was. And I went out one night asking myself this question: if there's a God, what must he be? And I realized he couldn't be like a judge sitting up there on a bench condemning us to hell because we've made a mistake. In fact, I thought the idea of eternal hell must be madness. To put it in modern terms, how can a finite cause have an infinite effect? It can't. But as I was thinking, I thought, well, what helps me to ask this question? The fact that I'm conscious. And if I'm conscious, where did my consciousness come from? It can't have come from the brain. I had read Descartes' theory, I think, therefore I am. But I found that the calmer my mind was, the more aware I was. Whereas the more restless it was, the less aware I was. So therefore the idea that I think and therefore I'm conscious doesn't work. Because the more I think, the less I'm able to be fully conscious. Whereas when I'm really conscious, I'm very still. So consciousness precedes thought. And I thought, well then, if I'm conscious, God must be consciousness. And if God is consciousness, my consciousness has to be linked to his consciousness. He had to bring everything into existence out of that consciousness. And my duty in that case is to be more in tune with his consciousness. And I figured his consciousness has to be, among other things, great clarity of awareness. And I noticed that there were times when I felt more uplifted and I was more aware, and times when I was less uplifted and not so much aware. And I realized then that the goal of life has to be the same for everybody. It has to be more in tune with God. How in tune, I had no idea. But I resolved that night that I would devote my life to seeking God. And whatever that meant for me, I thought it might mean a little peace of mind. Even that would be worth giving up everything to find. And I remember coming home to my apartment where I was living with four other guys. And they were laughing at me for being so serious, but I was really in a very serious frame of mind. I just realized that this was a moment in my life when I had discovered what I was meant to do. And I felt that their laughter, they were just like yapping puppies. And I went to my room and I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know if God would even listen to me if I prayed. But I resolved that night that I would seek him. And I went up when the Dock Street Theater closed for the summer. I went up to White Plains, where my parents were living at the time. Our home was in Scarsdale, but we had let the home because my father had been sent to Egypt. He was an exploration geologist for ESSO. And my mother was packing things up and getting ready to go. And I found, I borrowed her Bible and tried to read it. And I came to that part where so-and-so begat so-and-so, and he died, and somebody else begat so-and-so. I bogged down in the begats. It was just beyond me. I thought this may be a great scripture, but it doesn't say anything to me. And then I saw that she had a short world Bible on her shelf and little excerpts from all the different scriptures. And I read these, and most of them were poetic and some of them were beautiful, but I couldn't really make out what they were meaning. They didn't say anything to me personally. But when I came upon excerpts from the Hindu religion, I thought, this is for me. It talked of God as an infinite consciousness, not as a person. They said that to find him, you have to unite your consciousness with his. That was for me. That's what I knew had to be the truth. And it said that you must experience God. You can't just believe in him. Well, that was my stumbling point with religion, that it told you to believe, believe, believe. People used to believe the world is flat. That didn't make it so. People believed that the world was the center of the universe, and they found out that it isn't. And religion punished and condemned Galileo for 400 years. In fact, he wasn't forgiven by the Catholic Church until the 1970s. Hard to believe. Here, all the world knows that it's so, and still they held him under condemnation. This belief was a prime way of getting into greater ignorance, as far as I could see. And what I found in the Hindu excerpts was that if you want to know God, you must experience him. Well, to me, that made sense. And it said, if you want to know God, go to a solitary place and meditate and realize him in yourself. And I thought, well, that's what I want. And I wanted at first to be a hermit. Thank God I never did that. I was thinking of going to South America where it's cheap to live, living in a forest somewhere, a jungle, and spending my time meditating. And if I found a little peace of mind, maybe coming back and telling other people how they too could have peace of mind, that was the most I could dream of in finding God. And the day that I put my mother on the ship, this is how God works in our lives. The very day I put my mother on the ship to go join Dad in Cairo, I walked uptown New York and found Autobiography of a Yogi. And that book completely changed my life. I took virtually the next bus across the country. And the first words I addressed to Yogananda when I met him, and that too was a miracle. Hey, they told me I couldn't become a member there, a monk there for 4 years, till I'd finished the course. Then they told me I couldn't even see him for 2.5 months. His appointments were completely booked. And I was pretty discouraged, because all my life I'd had this particular blessing that if I really wanted something, I could get it. And it always worked for me. Even when it became a matter of passing a Greek test, which I hadn't studied for. But the one thing that I had really wanted was this, and I was being denied it or delayed, and I just couldn't understand it. I thought, well, maybe I'm not ready. I'll just live nearby and come to church and wait till I am ready, and then he'll accept me. And I was going out the door when Mary Hammond, who was the receptionist there, came to the door, and she said, well, since you've come from such a distance, I'll ask Master if he'll see you today. So she went, and when I saw him, the first words I said to him were something I never dreamed I'd say to anybody. I had a lot of arrogance, and I think I needed to be humbled by the thought that he wouldn't see me. The first time I'd found that I couldn't have something I really wanted. And when I accepted that, she came and said, I said, I want to be your disciple. I'd never dreamed I'd say those words to anybody. I wouldn't listen to anybody, because it had to come from inside. I didn't think anybody knew. I thought it was a matter of opinion, and I wanted more than opinion. But when I met him, when I read his book even, I knew, this man knows. And it went completely counter to everything I believed. It was my heart that accepted him, not my reason. My reason thought, my God, on page 8, this master is appearing in a wheat field to somebody? Impossible! But my heart accepted it completely because I knew that he was a man of integrity. I knew he wouldn't say it if he didn't fully believe it himself. And when he did agree to see me, he said, I want you to know I'm seeing you because Divine Mother told me to see you. There was a lady who came here 2 weeks ago from Sweden. I wouldn't see her because Divine Mother didn't tell me to. And again, he would tell me things that Divine Mother told him to tell me. It was a great experience for me, as you can imagine. But I found in time that this one thought that I thought I would just abandon was very much a part of his thinking, too, that what is needed in society, because he thought of the upliftment of society and not just of the enlightenment of a few disciples. He thought in terms of spreading this teaching in such a way as to uplift the whole of civilization. He had a vast mission, not just a small one. And one step toward the accomplishment of that mission was the creation of World Brotherhood colonies, as he put it. And I remember, and you heard me talking on that in that movie last night, how at the garden party in Beverly Hills, to which we were never invited again, how he talked with such fervor. I have never heard such a powerful talk in my life. And I vowed that day I would do everything I could to fulfill this ideal. And it wasn't long after that. I was standing with Herbert Fried, who was being sent to Phoenix as the minister there. And Master was in the car right in front of us, about to go out. And he was giving Herbert a few words of last-minute advice. And then he paused. I was very nearsighted, and I'm not nearsighted now because I've had laser surgery on my eyes. But I couldn't see clearly where he was directing his vision, although he was much closer to me than the front row here. And he said, you have a great work to do. And I turned to Herbert, naturally, wishing him felicitations, thinking this work in Phoenix was doing a great work. And Master said, it's you I'm talking to, Walter. And from then on, he kept saying these things. Or he would say, don't do such and such because you have a great work to do, or do such and such because you have a great work to do. And one time he said, of all the men disciples, apart from St. Lin, every man has disappointed me, and you mustn't disappoint me. And he said it with so much power. And I understood. I understood that he didn't mean that all his men disciples had disappointed him as disciples. But male energy is more outward, female energy is more inward. And he'd found in me someone who could carry his message out to the world. He said to some group of monks once, if Walter had come sooner, we would have reached millions. And I had that zeal to help other people too. But he said, you mustn't disappoint me. He counted on me to do something that otherwise wouldn't happen. And I knew he counted on me. And so when I began showing a little bit of enthusiasm in SRF, they began thinking, why can't he just wait to be told what to do? And the women were all in charge. When they put me on the board, I think they were kicking me upstairs just to shut me up. But it didn't work. Because I can't be shut up. When I believe in something, I'll go for it. And so they ended up, first of all, kicking me upstairs and finally kicking me out on my ear. And it was, to me, the best thing that ever happened. Didn't seem so at the time, because I thought that the only way I could serve my guru was through his organization. But what happened was that I found that in Calcutta, I remember Dr. Dash, who was on their board of directors in India, talking to me for a whole hour about what I should know before I could presume to teach these sophisticated Bengalis. And I knew much more than they did. They were all hooked in old ways of thinking. Master came and brought new ways. But in Bengal, they weren't open to me. I love Bengal. Bengal didn't love me. But when I came to Delhi, I found that crowds of 2,000 would come to my lectures and classes. And I thought, well, I can build this work here. Whereas in Calcutta, I can't do anything. I'm too young. They won't even listen until you're at least 60. And I was 33. I had a long wait ahead of me. So I decided that I would get land in New Delhi. Well, I went back. Diamata gave her approval to this. But many times she let me down, and this one she let me down greatly. Because when I announced what I had done, she just sent the letter around to the others and never told them that she had given me permission. So it looked as if I had done everything in purely presumption. Anyway, that's fine. It led to the best possible solution, so I don't mind. However, at the time, as I say, it was not easy. What happened was I got to Delhi, and I found that I couldn't possibly get land in Delhi. It was a government town, and they allowed land for hospitals, universities, schools, even businesses, but not for an ashram. Nehru was not a spiritual man, and he just felt that there India is clogged with ashrams. We need something different. And so they were the last priority. And I said, by my will, I'm going to make this happen. And I remember going out to the outskirts, which was where Qutub Minar is now, but it's Delhi's way beyond that now. There was an empty field, and beyond the horizon, they said there's a town there called Gurgaon, which really means Gurugram, Gurgaon, Gurugram. It was the home of Duryodhana, of Dronacharya in the Mahabharata. And anyway, that was too far away. The people didn't have cars in those days, and the buses stopped a long way short of the outskirts. And they said that everything on the outside was a green belt and you couldn't build there anyway. So I thought, well, I can't get land in the city. I can't get land out of the city. I'm going to get land where I want it. And there was a part where the green belt came in, sort of made a loop into the heart of the city. And right near Birla Mandir, there was 25 acres there that would have been absolutely perfect. Near the heart of the city, and yet in the Greenbelt area. And I said, that's what I want. And they all laughed at me. They said, it's not possible. There was a yoga ashram long before the Greenbelt area began that was just across the street from what I wanted. And the man came who, if you understand Hindi, he was considered a pakabanya, a perfect merchant. And he said, I've studied their bylaws, and I've seen that they are ruled by a majority vote of the members. I will simply buy up enough members and then give you the ashram. I said, I will not take it on those conditions. And he, being, as I said, a pakabanya, couldn't believe that I wouldn't accept it if he gave it to me. So he went up and bought up the memberships, and he came to me a couple of months later. He said, Swamiji, the ashram is yours. I said, I don't want it, and I refuse to take it. And he went away with his tail between his legs. But I would not take something away from somebody else. I would not do something adharmic. And so I went on trying. Finally, I wrote a letter to Bhagwan Sahaya, who was the chief commissioner of Delhi State. And I said to him that you think of this as a green belt area, and it's a wonderful affirmation because it's a green area outside the city, would provide lungs for the city. But it's not a greenbelt area. It's mostly sand and gravel and a few stunted shrubs. And I said that even as rich as Delhi is as a big city, it will take forever to build these thousands of acres into a good garden. You have one place, the Buddha Jayanti Park, in the greenbelt area that is an official thing. Why don't you let other people have parks? Institutions can build parks for you. And if there are enough of them, then they'll be able to make this truly a greenbelt area and not what it is now, which I said is a public latrine. And he called me and he asked me to come over and he said, I like your idea and I know that I could sway the other commissioners to it. But he said, I can't, since this decision came down from the very top of government, I can't get it without Nehru's permission. And I said, well, fine, would you ask him? Oh, no. You have to ask him. Well, that was like saying you have to go to the moon. and then I'll talk, then we'll talk. And, well, the people I was staying with were Kashmiri Brahmins, and the Nehru family was Kashmiri Brahmins. And a friend of the lady, in, Rani Bhan, was a friend of one of these aunties, a cousin of Nehru's. And so she took me there, and I talked to this cousin, and the cousin agreed to get me an appointment with Indira Gandhi. And the day that I met Indira Gandhi, she talked to me. She was a very haughty person, and she talked to me in a very haughty way. Be quick. She was only seeing me to as a favor to her auntie. I'm leaving for Paris tomorrow, and I have to pack, and I don't have time to talk very long. So what do you want? Like this. And I said, do you speak French? Yes. So I started talking French with her, and that sort of helped to melt her a little bit. And I said, well, where did you learn French? Oh, you'd never know. I said, well, just try me. So she said, well, I went to school in a little village in Switzerland called Villars. I said, I went to school in the next village. And that's where I learned French. And I used to pass your school every day walking. Well, she completely melted by this time. And I remember she took me out walking into their large garden and showed me a couple of little tiger cubs that somebody had given them. And by interesting coincidence, I visited the home of somebody in Pune whose father was the one who gave the, those tiger cubs to them. Anyway, she agreed to talk to her father about me. And to help convince them, I drew a picture of what I wanted, because they say a painting or a picture says more than 1,000 words. And when he came out, he would see people briefly on the way to the office, and the painting arrested his attention, and his daughter had told him about me. So anyway, the long and short of it was that he agreed to see me, which was already a miracle. Then the day that he did see me, a very close friend of his had died, and he was more thoughtful and perhaps more religious than usual, because he gave me a 40-minute private interview, which he didn't normally give to ambassador. He was a very impatient kind of person. And at the end of it, he said, I like what you're offering. I will walk down to that land and let you know my decision. And he went down and looked at it, and I got his permission. Well, this was a miracle. 1,700 other societies had tried to get land in that Greenbelt area. All of them had been turned down. And still he gave me this permission. I had put my will on the government of India, but I'd forgotten about my fellow disciples. I thought they'd be thrilled. And they were absolutely outraged. They decided I was a traitor. I was wanting to be the new guru. I wanted to nudge out Dayamata. Who knows what they had in mind? It was pure jealousy. And anyway, the long and short of that story was that was the beginning of my decline, which ended in my dismissal a year later. And for a while, it was a very difficult time for me because I didn't know what Master wanted of me. I believe in loyalty as a very important quality, but I began to doubt whether Master really loved me. And I reached the point where I said, even if you don't love me, you can't get rid of me that easily. I love you. And I wouldn't shake that thought. And then gradually I came back, and this is the final result. And I know now that what I am doing and what we are doing is what Master wanted. His real work is Ananda. They're stuck in the Middle Ages. But Ananda is progressive, and it's going into Dwapara Yuga. Now, in what way is Ananda a Dwapara Yuga kind of institution? This is a crucial question for us today. What is the sign of Dwapara Yuga? It is, more than anything else, energy. I have a grandniece who, she lives in Davis, and she told me a year ago that a word she hears all the time these days is energy. The sign of Dwapara Yuga, there are two signs of Dwapara. One is energy, and the other is that it's a time when man overcomes the delusion of space. Even now, at the beginning of Dwapara Yuga, we can see the probability of being able to travel in space. But to demolish space as a delusion, that will come too. And the means of people coming from distant galaxies here, physically speaking, would not be possible. But there are other ways of traveling, as Master put it. They will be able to come even from distant galaxies. And the UFOs that you read about, if a UFO were to land there, I'm sure I'd be looking in the wrong direction. I don't seem to be blessed with these experiences myself, but I know that they're true. And the spatial delusion will be demolished. Then when you come to Treta Yuga, the delusion of time will be demolished, and the delusion of the need to communicate with words. They'll be aware that matter itself is composed not of energy, but of thoughts. And in Satya Yuga, they become aware that thoughts even are just manifestations of consciousness, and that everything in the universe is really only a vibration, endless numbers of vibrations of consciousness. God is without motion, the spirit beyond creation. And when he wanted to create, he couldn't create it the way you would a car. He had nothing to create it out of. Everything exists in his consciousness. It's a vibration. And science has brought us to this point, and this is the hallmark of having come out of Kali Yuga, that we know now that matter is not the reality that it seemed to be. It's only a vibration, or again, billions, trillions of vibrations of energy. And when we can understand that the underlying that energy, and many scientists have posited this possibility now, that energy itself is really a vibration of thoughts. And when they go deeper still, they'll understand that those thoughts are just vibrations of consciousness. Om, this is why it says in the Bible, in the beginning there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The Word is Om, it's not the Bible. The Bible was written on paper. You didn't have paper in those days. It's a matter of the Word. The words of my thoughts are, the vibrations of my thoughts are expressed through words. And so the vibrations of God's consciousness was expressed in the manifestation that we know of as creation. Everything, however, really exists in consciousness, and only that consciousness is real. Now, in that highest age, many people will understand that the reality of everything is God. In every age, some people understand it, but most people don't. I used to think that this makes such perfect sense that everybody must accept it. But I fell flat with my own relatives. I found that if you're not interested, you're not going to talk. We don't have millions of people here today. We have a few hundred. Because not very many people are ready to understand or to accept that the goal of life is spiritual and not physical. They still think, like a cousin of mine said, a cousin of my mother's, therefore a second cousin of mine, I told her that desires are not the way to be happy because fulfilling them doesn't give you happiness. And her answer was, well, I still think I'll be happier when I get that sofa. What are you going to do? People have to come to this point of their own accord. This is why I was right in that play. It isn't that God wants us to suffer, but he created suffering as a corrective. When you go wrong, you suffer. Just as if a child touches a hot stove, he knows he mustn't touch it again because it hurts. And when you are hurt by wrong living, then you learn not to live that way again. But without pain, you could go and err a million times and still be happy. The law of the world is such that if you go against that law, you suffer. And so over many lifetimes, we find, I mustn't touch this, I mustn't touch this. Finally, what can I touch? My own self. It's the only thing you can touch. The only thing you can ever go into and understand everything. The scientist can learn everything about the atom, but he won't know the atom. The yogi can know everything about himself, trace himself down to that ultimate little atom that is his own sense of ego, and then go behind that ego he finds God. Now, another interesting thing there. Somebody asked me yesterday, why does one need a guru? Many people say you don't need a guru. I remember reading in India, in the Times of India a few years ago, that nowadays, with literacy so widespread and books so easy to purchase and libraries everywhere, nobody needs a guru. He can go and read all that truth. That's not what a guru gives you. A guru gives you his magnetism. A guru gives you his energy. And with that energy, you find that your consciousness changes. There was a story that my guru told me of a man who was being bothered by a demon. This is a story in India, obviously, because the man was reading in the scriptures about a certain mantra that he could use, and he recited this thing onto a handful of powder, and then threw the powder onto the demon. And the demon laughed at him. He said, before you could even throw that powder, I myself got into it. So how could that powder affect me? This, as many stories are, was an analogy. It was a metaphor that your ego is already infected with the delusion, with the disease of the delusion of being real. And your reasoning power won't get you out of that. You can think about your ego and it just won't take you anywhere. It was like a dream I had many years ago, a few years ago, in which I was flying. And I thought, well, this is a weird thing to do. Maybe I'm dreaming. So I tried by reason to tell whether I'm awake or dreaming. And my own reasoning, but dream reasoning, told me I was doing something strange, but it was still real. I was really flying. And what was my surprise a moment later to wake up and realize that in spite of all my reasoning, it had been a dream anyway. And so here we are in this dream, and it looks so real. One little puff of death, and it'll no longer be real. One little puff of realization, you see, the whole thing has been a dream. And it seemed real. And it seems real for incarnation after incarnation until finally you shake loose that delusion. But in the Bible it says, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God. And most people think that receiving Jesus Christ means believing in him. It means much more than that. To receive him and to receive his consciousness into yours. To have a guru means to be in tune with his consciousness. And I have found that the more in tune I am with my guru, the more I find answers coming to me, understanding coming to me, everything good coming to me. Ananda itself is the fruit of that attunement. And the need for a guru, Swami Shankaracharya, the first or Adi Shankara, said that the greatest blessing in all the three worlds, the material universe, the astral universe, the causal universe, the greatest blessing in all the three universes is to have a living, a true guru, one who is alive in God. We have this blessing, and it pays to be loyal and to follow that very strongly, firmly. I have done that in my life. And I've done it because I've gone through many lifetimes of rebellion, of doubt. Master told me once I was eaten up with doubts. It's made me a good teacher. You know, when you break a bone, what heals that bone is stronger than the bone around it. And so when you have a fault, don't think of yourself as a sinner or anything. Because sooner or later you'll overcome that fault. You have to. You're a child of God. You have no choice. But once you've overcome it, that will be one of your strongest things. So now faith is one of my strongest suits, just because I have been a doubter. I know every doubt anybody could have. I could anticipate them. But it's made me a good teacher. Because I know what people worry about, and I know how to answer their questions. And I have seen again and again, don't worry about some unfaithful disciple. We're all unfaithful sooner or later. You know, Dhirananda, he betrayed Master and tried to destroy him. And Master said that he will find God in another three lifetimes. That's quite a promise. You'd think anybody who can be that bad. Judas found God and liberation in this last century. And people think of him as the supreme villain of all history. Master told me he was a prophet. But he had this desire for money, and he was not faithful yet. But Jesus was faithful to him. This is the wonderful thing about the Guru. I remember he said to Mr. Cuaron, the head of our center in Mexico City, "I lost sight of you for a few lifetimes, but now I have you again. I'll never lose sight of you again. I have my grip on you now." That meant Cuaron had reached that point where he'd learned his lessons. And the Guru's purpose is to take you through your delusions and bring you to that point. I talked about Treta Yuga as being a time when time will be demolished. I had a very interesting experience in India. I encountered a book called the Book of Bhrigu, who was a great saint in Treta Yuga in ancient India, the downward cycle of Treta Yuga. And he wrote these pages of predictions of people who had yet to live. And I found a page on my life. And it told me that, first of all, that usually gives you your last life, your present life, and your next life. This one he didn't give my next life because I won't have one, at least not by karmic compulsion, which is nice to hear, but still has to be proved. However, the present life, he said you were born in Romania, your father named you James. Nobody knew my name was James. It's James Donald Walters, but I was always called Donald. And yet, he said that. He said you were born in Romania, grew up in America. You have brothers, but no sister is possible. No living sister is possible. One will die in your mother's womb. And when I got home to America, I asked my mother if she'd had a miscarriage. She said, yes, she had one. I hadn't ever known about it. He told me I would go back to America within 2 months. I left in 2 months, less than 2 months. He told me of different things that would happen that have come true. He said my name would be Kriyananda, and it is. He said my guru's name would be Yogananda. He talked about the results of bad karmas as well as good karmas, and they've all come true. And it's an amazing thing that somebody who lived thousands of years ago could know these things today. But these are the signs of the different yugas. It's all Master in his poem Samadhi said all thoughts past, present, to come are a part of his present consciousness in that Samadhi. And you may ask yourselves, and probably will ask yourselves, as I asked myself, how can there be free will if somebody knows some thousands of years ago that we're going to be wearing a red tie on this Sunday or something? Well, it's because at any given moment of time, we always try to do that which will make us happy. And we have delusions as to what will make us happy, but our desire for happiness is the one abiding reality of human existence. All human beings try to avoid pain and to find happiness. And in the beginning, they think happiness will come from drinking, money, sex, pleasure, power, fame, all these things. And gradually, they become more refined. They reach the point where they are free. And yet, even Jesus Christ's crucifixion could be predicted and was predicted long before he was born. And so we see that the ability to do something totally unexpected is not the sign of free will. You can't do anything that's not predictable at a certain level of consciousness. Free will means when you can act for your own highest happiness, but you can never be free from God, and therefore you can never act independently of him. And the whole concept of free will is a complete delusion. You aren't free. There's no hope of being free. And the thing is that God has his talons in you and you can't get away. You might as well give up. I'm joking, because you have to do it with your own free will. And in fact, in the beautiful epic, the Mahabharata, Bhishma, who represents the ego, has the power not to die until he himself decides to die. And at the end of the battle, he's lying there, riddled with arrows, giving a lecture on kingship. And he doesn't die until he himself says, now I want to go. So the ego has to offer itself up. As Jesus said, who would save his life shall lose it. Who will give up his life for my sake shall find it. But you finally have to make that offering. You have to say, yes, I offer myself into the infinite. And that's not an easy thing to do, because it looks as if you're offering yourself into nothingness. And at the end, you realize what you've done is, in that emptiness, suddenly comes cosmic bliss. So this is the goal and end of life. But in this book, it talked about these things, and it said that in the time of Kurukshetra, I was the ruler of a small kingdom in England, in India, and I was afraid that I would be on the wrong side. And as a result, I gave my kingdom over to my son and went off into the forest and took initiation from a guru. And I went into it, and it said he achieved shanti in his vrittis, which is probably sabhikalpa samadhi. But then he argued with his guru, and his guru told him, because you haven't accepted me properly, you will have to wander until you meet Yogananda. Fascinating, just amazing that they can say these things. And I know that I've been through many things, much grief and much suffering. And in my music even, if you listen sensitively, you'll hear a certain undernote of sadness. Because although I'm basically a very happy person, I'm aware of the unhappiness of life. I'm aware that life is very painful until you find the way out of it. And that's what goads me to help other people. Now, Ananda Community is Master's way and my way of helping to make this a reality. And what is it that makes it possible in this Dwapara Yuga? This is an age of energy. And we have to understand that energy and magnetism are realities. And the kind of people you mix with will, to a large extent, determine the kind of person you are. Therefore, it's very important to develop and live in an environment of people who are compatible with your own highest aspirations. You may think, no, I will live a good life wherever I am. Maybe you will, maybe you will. Maybe you're strong enough to do so. But let's face it, the chances are not very strongly in your favor. Most people take on the magnetism of the places around you and the people around you. I remember somebody told me that some singer might sing a song of mine, and I thought, well, it might be worth getting this man to sing them. So I went into the nightclub district of San Francisco at that time to look for this man who was singing in a nightclub. And I could feel, as I passed each bar and nightclub, these tentacles, come in, come in. And I was singing all the time, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om, Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram Om. And I felt nothing but bliss. But if you can feel that bliss inwardly and project it, you can be protected. But you're not going to do it all the time. And the chances are that if you're not living with people who have, especially if you're new on the path, who have compatible vibrations with your own, that they will pull you down. The law of magnetism is this, that a weak magnet will be influenced by a strong magnet. And you can't get away from that law. That's why shaking hands with people is a very important act. It's an exchange of magnetism, the horseshoe of the heads and of the feet. Two magnets at work there. I remember Master told me in 1949 to stand outside the church and shake hands with people. And I suppose because they thought that I was acting as his emissary, that I said to Master afterwards, please don't have me do this again. I feel completely drained. because they were shaking my hand thinking they were taking a blessing from Master. And he said, that's because you're thinking of yourself. Think of God and you won't be drained. His energy will flow through you. And I found it was true. I had more energy afterwards than before. But living in community, somebody said to me a few years ago, you have some wonderful people living here. I said, it's what they're doing that makes them wonderful. And it isn't only what they're doing in the sense of meditating and serving. It's also true because the more they live with people who have these ideals, the more they take on these ideals. You can see people's consciousness changing in a matter of weeks once they move here. Their eyes become clearer. They show more integrity. They show more happiness, devotion to truth and joy. These things you see in the faces of people around here. You sent me a picture of Ananda faces. I didn't like the picture. They were all smiling. Anybody can smile. It was nice not because they were smiling. They could have looked serious. I spent 4 days in the presence of a great saint in southern India, and he hardly ever smiled. But there was such bliss in his eyes. That's where you see it. Not in the lips, but in the eyes. They were all good people, and you could see that. But it wasn't the smile that did it. It was the eyes. When you live with other people who live for God and have God as their ideal, you find that it's much easier to find God or to raise your consciousness than it is in the cities, where you end up thinking you're doing a good thing if you help a little old lady across the street. There's so much more to being good than that. How can you learn to love everybody when everybody around you is insulting you or trying to pull you down or jealous of you if you do well and all the various emotions you find in this world? How can you? It's very difficult, but when you live with other people, all of whom have this kindness, you begin to understand that God is really everywhere. And why should we love everybody? Well, it's very simple. Because everybody in the world is seeking that one thing, bliss. They don't know it. The worst mafioso thinks he's looking for money and power and revenge and all sorts of wrong emotions. But he's still looking for happiness according to his own lights. And he'll find out sooner or later that it doesn't give happiness. And bit by bit, he will become refined. And how long does it take to achieve this level of refinement? Well, I asked Master one time, sir, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? Because somebody had a vision seeing him on the Moria. When the Moria went down, whether the vision was true or not, it sure put the fear of God into me. And I said, have I been your disciple for thousands of years? He said, it's been a long time, that's all I'll say. I said, does it always take so long? I didn't want to think of myself as the only laggard in the crowd. And he said, yes, desires for name and fame take them away again and again. Why did he mention name and fame? I assume it's because of something I wanted in the past, and so he singled those faults out. But it could have been desires for many other things too. And I haven't had the slightest desire for those things in this life. It means nothing to me. And yet, many lifetimes it takes. I remember Norman saying to Master, sir, I don't think I have very good karma, Master. Master said, remember this, it takes very, very, very good karma even to want to know God. And you can't implant that desire in people. They can only reach it when they've tried everything else and they find and are completely convinced that every other path leads to disillusionment, disappointment, and sorrow. And when you know that to your depths, nothing can shake you. But otherwise, the path is not easy. It's the only path there is and the only path that will work. But people think, well, maybe if I do this or that or the other thing, and it doesn't work for them, and so they come back again and again, and maybe they wander for a few lifetimes like Kwannon, and then they come back. But why waste all that time? I think that we in this community have a very good karma, because I see there's this level of sincerity here that is unusual. I think I can say I haven't seen it anywhere else, and I've lived at Mount Washington. The quality must be fanned by daily effort, but mix with those here in the community or in our communities who will uplift you by their magnetism. Don't mix with those who are negative. Master said once, if there are two negative people in a class, they'll always smell each other out. Mix with positive people. Their influence will uplift you, and it's very important to do so. Don't mix with those who doubt. Don't mix with those who have things they're working on that might pull you down, too. You'll find in any group of people, if there's anyone negative, he'll mix with those who are negative. They want justification. Mix with those who are positive. Mix with those who think in terms of what they can give, not in terms of what they can get. This is why I don't tell people that one of the supreme reasons for living in community is that it's the best insurance possible. But that's a selfish reason. It is the best insurance possible. When you've got a whole community behind you, even when there's a Great Depression, as one is coming now, you find that a group of people can hang together in a way that individuals cannot. And they will lose their jobs, and they may starve to death. I say it seriously. The times we're coming to are much worse than we're facing right now. It's going downhill. In a group of people, they can grow their own food. They can live simply. They can live away from the madding crowd, so to speak. That I don't offer. I'm offering it now as a fact, but I don't want to offer it as an inducement to join Ananda, because I want people to come here because they love God and because they want to find God. Can you find God alone as a hermit? Well, I must tell you, I wanted to be a hermit, and I would not have known what the hell to do. I was just completely at sea. When you learn with other people and you learn the right attitudes, and you have to learn to give, to be generous, to be kind. It's in a way selfish to be a hermit unless you are able to maintain a level of samadhi that keeps you completely engrossed in God, like Ram Gopal Majumdar. But otherwise, to live with others and to live a self-giving life, this is essential. These communities, I believe, are going to be the wave of the future. And many of them will form for the selfish reasons that I have given, because they're valid reasons. I have read articles in magazines and papers sent to me from America, because I wasn't in America at the time, urging people to get together and buy land in the country. That's what Master talked about. He said that live simply. Live in a place where you can have your own job, your own school, your own church, everything in one place. Live close to God, live with other people who love God. And he said that this idea would spread like wildfire. I think that although Ananda at the present time might be described as one of the best kept secrets in America, I think the time is coming when they will turn to us, because after 40 years of experience, we know what we're doing. We know what will work. We know what will not work. One very important thing is that you learn the importance of giving and not taking. You learn the importance of sharing. This is one reason I don't think I could have started Ananda communities anywhere but in America. Americans of all countries that I know in the world have a talent for cooperation. They learned it in coming to these shores. They learned it in forming little communities in the West and so on. We, from the very beginning, when the Pilgrim Fathers first came, they had to work together and live together and worship together. And in this way alone could they have survived, because after all, the Indians were against them, the American Indians. And who wouldn't have been? We were the invaders. You can't blame the Indians. But nonetheless, this is what happened, so we have to accept it. Master said that America has very good karma. He said that in the coming times, America will survive. He said Europe will be devastated. Russia will be annihilated. These are strong words. But the times that we are coming into are very difficult times. And it is very true that more and more people are being advised and beginning to think seriously in terms of, let me live close to the land where I can grow my own food, where I can live simply. The mortgage on your home is probably not going to be yours very long if you have it. There are many things that are coming to an end. What is really happening is that for 100 years now, over 100 years now, we have been in Dwapara Yuga. And the old Kali Yuga ways of thinking are becoming more and more confronted by this wave of new consciousness, energy, flow. Not the kind of religion that is fixed and dogmatic, but something that is experienced and understood, that we go with in a flow, that we have to understand that the world is one. It's not just separate little countries all fighting for their own rights. There's a whole change in the world today which is being opposed by old institutions. And that opposition is not going to be an easy one. It's been building up for a century now. And if you look at every field of human endeavor, you find just chaos. Look at the arts. That's been my particular field. And the paintings, the sculptures. Look at the sculptures you pass on the streets on these buildings. They just look preposterous. It's hard to believe that anybody could take this seriously. The art, I remember in a hotel in Holland, I thought I wouldn't want to be in a room with a painting like that. And here it's in the lobby. The arts, people don't think that they've lost touch with the meaning of life. And you find that in every walk of life. You find that in the philosophy of life, where people tell you, taking their beliefs from science, that life has no meaning. There's no purpose to it all. There's no God. There's no moral values. There are nothing. Well, we've given answers to all of those things in terms of their own logic. But people are still stuck in their own ways of thinking, and they're thinking, if it's not that, then it can't be anything. Well, all of that is crumbling, and we're coming to the paying off point. Depression, yes, massive depression. I mean, people starving to death in the streets. Warfare, inevitable. When you've got that much chaos, you've got revolution. I remember one time in Los Angeles, Master had another decree from City Hall about something, and the way people do, they jokingly said, oh, there ought to be a revolution. Then he paused a moment. He said, there will be one. Well, I believe that's very likely in this country. I think that the likelihood of war is worse than, it's not just likely, it's almost inevitable. There are 30,000 known atomic weapons in the world today. That doesn't account for the unknown ones. People could bring atom bombs across the border easily. Only 2% of what comes in a ship is examined in customs. It could easily be that somebody brings in an atom bomb and destroys New York or other cities in this country. This terrorism is a reality. And there are people who think that they're doing God a favor by killing everybody. And of course, if they got everybody dead who didn't agree with them, they'd be fighting each other, because such is human nature. But the reality of war is great, and when there's that much chaos, there's a reality of something else to be considered. We don't live in an isolated position on our little mud ball of a planet. We live in a cosmic environment, and the chances of a huge cataclysm are very great. Cataclysm is something nature made, not man made. I know in church on Sunday morning, Master one time stopped his talk about depression, which he said is certain to come. But then he paused and he said, you don't know what a terrible cataclysm is coming. And cataclysm means more than depression. Depression is born of human greed. But cataclysm would be something hitting the earth. He said, Padre Pio said, the children of Garibandal were told by the Virgin Mary. These things are things to be taken seriously. When people like that say these things, they're to be listened to. And all three of them have talked about 3 days of darkness. Padre Pio said, don't go outdoors when that comes, because there will be a poison in the atmosphere even. what could cause this? If it's a volcano, that would take years for the dust to settle. The only thing I can think is something hitting the Earth with so much power that it stops its rotation for a while. And whereas we have 3 days of darkness, in India and China they'll have 3 days of light. And 3 days of sun in India would be just as bad as 3 days of darkness here. And then the internal motion of the world comes on. There have been a number of books on a polar shift. It's possible. These things have happened in the past. And with a shift from one yoga to the next is the normal time that these things do happen. So be prepared for such things. But do take very seriously what I'm talking about when I say, join Ananda or create another community like Ananda. Get land in the country where you can grow your own food. We have developed a system of permaculture here. We're developing it, of which I completely approve. It's a wonderful thing that brings you much more fruit out of the soil. An interesting thing is that the spinach of 1920 had about 90% more food value in it than it has today. Why? Dorothy, who was one of the Findhorn people, and they used to commune with these astral deities that provide vegetables and so on. Very interesting. I went there and visited. And she came here one time and visited, and she said there are devas everywhere, but she said that the devas are withdrawing from this planet because we no longer have any respect for nature. We don't think in terms of cooperating with nature. We think of conquering nature. You have to learn to respect what you do. Respect the food. Love the food. They've even made experiments on this, that with one plant they would direct love to it, to another plant they would direct hatred. The one to which they directed love flourished. The one to which they directed hatred died. And this is an experiment that had been done repeatedly, always, as far as I know, with the same results. Take it seriously. When you can learn to have that consciousness, we, with our consciousness here, things flourish in this atmosphere. Build communities wherever you are. Build communities. You'll be away from the cities where there will be chaos. Just imagine trucks trying to bring food in to a starving city. They'll be stopped at the outskirts. How will the people in the inside even get that food? This is no joke I'm talking about. I'm talking about something very serious. The nice thing about an atomic war is that it can't last long. Not many people around when it's left, but yes, it'll destroy many people. Don't be afraid. When you love God, God does take care of you, will take care of you. And whether you die now or not really isn't very important, because in a sense you have to say that this whole planet is a concentration camp. In 100 years we'll all be gone. The only difference is you don't see this one dying of cancer and that one dying of a heart attack and this one. But there are terrible things going on in this planet because they go one by one. We keep hoping for the best. But 100 years from now, there isn't anybody alive today. We'll be here then. A handful, but not many. So remember that. In any case, to love God, you'll be coming back again and again. You're stuck with that. You can't help it. But when you can get out of this desire to come back, that's when you'll be freer. Seek that freedom and love God. He will take care of you whatever happens. But if you love him, you will be protected. This master promised us, and I know it's true, because I've seen that protection again and again in my life. Now then, when you start communities, you'll be starting a pattern of a way of life. It doesn't have to be an Ananda community. If Ananda had 100,000 communities in the world, God, think of the logistics. Think of the administration. We'd be another Catholic Church. I wouldn't want it. I don't think that we're doomed to have another super church. Master said the future of religion would be self-realization. The truth of religion has to be inside. Jesus Christ said, that the kingdom of God is inside you. You don't have to go outside. You don't have to have hierarchies of priests and cardinals and so on. Your real church is your body. You take this church with you wherever you are, and you can worship him wherever you go. This will be the religion of the future. And I think that Ananda, I pray that Ananda will be not supervising communities, but inspiring communities. Because after 40 years, we, as I said, we can say with a certain amount of confidence, we know what we're doing. And that knowledge, I would like many of you who live here to think in terms of going out and starting other communities. And yes, you might want to call it an Ananda community because we all believe in these things. One thing, though, if you do that, make our gurus your main reality. I think of them as the avatars of this age and of Master particularly. And I think there's a benefit in having each community dedicated to one spiritual teaching, one spiritual path. I know in the beginning, they were cooking with onions in the kitchen at the meditation retreat, and somebody came in and said, oh, Krishna doesn't like onions. And I said, listen, this is not Krishna's kitchen, it's Yogananda's kitchen, and Yogananda liked onions. This thing of having to tiptoe around, I mean, supposing we had lots of people here who didn't believe in reincarnation, well, out of consideration and respect, we'd have to be quiet in their presence if we wanted to talk about something that's central to our beliefs. Why not be able to relax in your own living room? I say that when you have a community, it should at least agree on certain basic truths, basic principles, spiritual principles primarily. Then you'll have peace in your, as I said, in your own living room. But at any rate, if you do start communities, do it with a group. I do believe in the need for it. I don't think people need to come to Ananda from Taiwan or Hong Kong or all over the world. Yes, Ananda has done something wonderful, but those things are needed elsewhere too. I do think that it's more difficult in the cities. I think that country living is finally going to be the answer, and I'd like to see more and more such communities started everywhere. Why do you need communities? Not just for the sake of the individuals living in them, who are helped magnetically by the presence of other people, but also for the effect that it has on other people. If everybody in this community went to a different city, got a job in a different office, lived in the suburbs in his own little house, and he carried with him the peace of meditation so that when there were the usual office squabbles, he was above them and didn't get affected by them and was an influence for peace. And people would finally begin to notice this and they'd say, well, how come you're always so peaceful? And he'd say, well, I meditate and I have faith in God. Well, they would probably say, I think it's because you take bran for breakfast. They'd try to reduce it to the lowest possible level of their own experience. When you have a group of people living together and all of them being like this, like that man who said you have some wonderful people here, and I said it's not the individuals. If you saw them individually, you might say they're wonderful people, but when you see so many, you have to say it's what they're doing that makes them that way, and the magnetism that they develop in doing it, which I didn't say, but that's a major part of that truth. It's having communities where people can see it being practiced by a number of people that becomes convincing to other people. So when people say, oh, but you're running away from life, this is life. Why do we have to know what life is by being with them? We're not running away. We're offering an example that can be useful to people wherever they live. And that is being useful to people wherever they live. Because people from all over the world write and say that our lives are more meaningful because of what you are doing here. I look back over these 40 years and over the many more years since I first came up with this idea and dedicated my life to forming such a thing. I look back on it with a lot of satisfaction because I find that it does work and that it is a model that can help to change the world in a positive way.